Beyond Barbarossa, episode 93. On 30 January 1945, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill arrived at the Mediterranean island of Malta, where he met with the combined chiefs of staff, the top military brass of the UK and the USA. For the next 4 days, they discussed the final campaign against Germany on the Western Front. On the final day of the Malta Conference, 2nd February, U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt, fresh off his fourth consecutive election win for the top political position in the country, arrived in Malta. Now, according to multiple authors and sources, the agenda for these Roosevelt-Churchill talks was not so much the military details on the Western Front. That was better left to the professional soldiers. But to discuss what they would soon be talking about with Joseph Stalin and his acolytes at the next conference in the Crimean port of Yalta. And that's what this episode will be about. From Malta to Yalta. From Malta to Yalta, episode 93 of Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. Thanks for dialing in. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting from the Redbeard Studio on traditional Anishinaabe Algonquin land, also called Ottawa, in free, independent, and sovereign Canada. A middle power with a lot to offer. And at time of writing, in a deep cold. We love it like this. And of course, I'm joined today in the studio with my indispensable assistant, Daisy the Danger Doodle. Last episode brought us to the end of January 1945 on the Eastern Front, an important moment when the big three leaders of the United States, United Kingdom, and Union of Soviet Socialist Republics met to make plans that would, as the world would see, shape geopolitics and geoeconomics, a global world order, if you will, for the next 80 years. Until a 21st century American president blew it up. But that's a subject for another podcast. Several podcasts, actually. The moment that I'm talking about actually spanned 2 weeks. The Malta and Yalta conferences from 30 January to 11th February 1945. In these two pivotal conferences, the Allies' political and military leaders planned the end of the Second World War. Yes, by February 1945, the end was in sight. One clear sign of this was where these meetings were held, Malta and Yalta. Both had been scenes of warfare not long before. During the fighting in North Africa from 1940 to 1942, Malta was the most heavily bombed place in Europe. And Yalta, of course, is on the Crimean Peninsula, occupied by Germany until May 1944 and the end of bitter, bloody warfare. Even though these places were safe enough for the top leaders of the world to meet, there was still a lot of war to come, a lot of killing, a lot of dying and destruction. That's what the three leaders would talk about in Malta and Yalta. Their discussions would lay bare the inconsistencies and incompatibility of their respective military aims, political goals, and worldviews. It's important at this point, before we get into the conferences themselves, to establish the context. So, as always, let's look at what's going on in the war. But this time, it's not what else is going on in the war, because the discussions in Yalta would involve all theaters of the Second World War, Europe, the Pacific, and Southeast Asia. In Europe, the Western Allies had liberated almost all of France and Belgium with the exception of German salients in the Ardennes Forest and Alsace. And there were US and UK armies at the German border, especially along the Rhine. Map 2 on the webpage shows the fronts in Europe as of 1st February 1945. The main action on the Western Front in the winter of 1944-45 was the well-known Battle of the Bulge, also called the German Ardennes Offensive in Belgium and northeastern France. By late January 1945, it had clearly failed. German offensive, that is. The German forces were withdrawing from the Bulge after the American 1st and 3rd Armies linked up in mid-January, leaving the German 6th Panzer Army in a tighter and tighter salient. North of there, British and Canadian forces finished Operation Black Hawk at the end of January, eliminating a German bridgehead over the rivers Ruhr and Würm, out of southern Netherlands and deeper into western Germany. Meanwhile, south of the Bulge, the French 1st Army finished eliminating the Colmar Pocket, the last German bridgehead west of the Rhine River in southern Alsace. In northern Italy, Allied forces had penetrated the so-called Gothic Line across the peninsula in the fall. But a combination of difficult terrain, there are lots of mountains in Italy, and winter weather had left them largely stalled south of the Po River Valley. In the Netherlands, Canadian forces had crossed the Scheldt estuary, securing the port of Antwerp to allow Allied shipping. The fighting there stalled again along the Maas or Meuse River in the Netherlands for months. A particular problem for the Allies was a German bridgehead at a ferry crossing called Kapellschwier, sometimes mistranslated as Kapellschwier. After Polish units and British Royal Marines had failed to capture the crossing, the attempt fell to Canadian units, the Lincoln and Welland Regiment, the Argyll and Southern Highlanders of Canada, and tanks from the South Alberta Regiment. Using heavy artillery bombardment, followed by short advances and consolidation, the so-called bite-and-hold tactics, the Canadians captured the crossing in 5 days, ending on 31st January. On the Eastern Front, the Red Tide continued, with German forces holding on desperately at Königsberg and the Samland Peninsula, as described last episode. It was on 27 January that the Red Army liberated the Auschwitz complex of concentration and death camps. The next day, the Red Army announced the completion of conquering Lithuania. In Poland, General Chukov's 1st Guards Tank Army and 8th Guards Army were besieging Poznan, one of the cities Hitler had decided must be held by the Germans until they were all dead. And on 31st January, the Red Army crossed the Oder River, bringing them less than 80 kilometers or 50 miles from Berlin. In the Pacific, 25th January, the U.S. Navy bombarded Iwo Jima in advance of the landing on the island in February, and the beginning of some of the fiercest fighting in the Pacific War. On 3rd February, U.S. and Philippine forces began the Battle of Manila, which led to a massacre when occupying Japanese soldiers killed some 100,000 civilians. American and Filipino forces also continued liberating other Philippine islands, such as Marinduque. American planes bombed Japanese positions in the Caroline Islands, Marshall Islands, and the Bonin Islands. Shifting a little bit further west in Southeast Asia, Chinese troops finished clearing Japanese troops from the Lido Road from British India into China. And the British and Commonwealth forces were pressing closer to Mandalay in Burma. And that's all shown in maps 2 and 3 on the webpage of this episode. That was the situation as Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin conversed, discussed, argued, harangued, and ate and drank gallons of vodka and champagne in February 1945. So let's head to Malta. It's a very pleasant place, an island in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea with a gentle Mediterranean climate. A great place to be at the end of January. UK Prime Minister Winston Churchill arrived there, on 30 January 1945, as mentioned in the introduction. There he met with the chiefs of military staff from the UK and the US, who had already gathered to make plans for the final stages of the war in Western Europe. At this point, it was clear to all but the most fanatical Nazis that Germany would soon lose the war. But it was still a dangerous foe. Like a wounded, cornered, wild predator, it could still kill, as it showed at the Ardennes Offensive, or the Battle of the Bulge, and at Ravenna, in Belgium, in the Netherlands, and at Strasbourg. What the Allied generals developed was the final campaign into Germany itself. Churchill, however, had a different aim for going to Malta. He wanted to talk with Roosevelt to form a united front with the US to bring to Stalin at their upcoming meeting in Yalta. Yalta, in the USSR. Unfortunately, from Churchill's point of view, that's not what happened. Roosevelt arrived in Malta on the last day of the conference, 2nd February. According to multiple sources, Roosevelt refused to discuss Yalta with Churchill. He reportedly did not want to appear to be ganging up on Stalin. Instead, he believed, according to his closest friends and aides, that he could charm Stalin, and he could do so far more effectively than Churchill could. I don't doubt that Franklin Roosevelt was more charming than Churchill. There are probably badgers more charming than Winston Churchill. But Roosevelt's idea that he could convince Stalin to uphold the freedom of the Eastern and Central European nations that the Red Army conquered, especially given the history of the USSR's oppression of the Baltic states, Ukraine, Poland, and other countries before 1941, as well as Stalin's opportunistic alliance with Nazi Germany, and the current reports of mass rapes and other war crimes already happening in East Prussia. Given all that, I don't think that Roosevelt knew what he was up against. Roosevelt has been described as incredibly naive because of this. Some, with certain political views, have described him as a traitor for his approach to Stalin at Yalta. I don't believe that. But I'm not going to try to put myself in Roosevelt's head, especially 80 years later. I do think that Roosevelt was mistaken. It's pretty clear he was mistaken about his ability to charm Stalin into his point of view. But I will point out that Roosevelt, who had suffered from polio, was at this point very ill. Just take a look at the pictures I put up on the webpage showing Roosevelt in 1944 and then in February 1945, where he's meeting with Churchill at Yalta. You can see he's lost a lot of weight. He just does not look well. Averell Harriman, his confidant and at this point ambassador to the USSR, wrote about Roosevelt's appearance at Yalta. Quote, "I was terribly shocked at the change since our talks in Washington. The signs of deterioration seemed to me unmistakable." End quote. In fact, by this point, Roosevelt was being treated for congestive heart failure and an enlarged heart. A dangerous condition, especially for someone facing extreme stress every day, not to mention traveling across an ocean. But because of the very conditions that brought about that stress, Roosevelt had to keep that secret. Even so, those close to him knew he was life-threateningly ill. When he arrived in Malta, Churchill also was not well. He was suffering from a heavy cold and a fever, which he tried to cure with the tried-and-true whiskey and cigars. Roosevelt and Churchill did agree on one thing in Malta that February. They did not want the Red Army to get any farther west than absolutely necessary. On to Yalta. In the evening of 2nd February, American and British delegations left Malta for Yalta on the Black Sea. This was a huge affair, in total about 700 people. Roosevelt traveled on the presidential plane. This was the first plane dedicated to the President of the United States. It was a Douglas C-54 transport plane officially named the Flying White House, but more commonly known as the Sacred Cow. Five P-58 fighters accompanied it. Reportedly, they flew at low altitudes to reduce altitude stress on the ailing president, but this subjected them to rough turbulence. So, despite his efforts, Roosevelt did not sleep well on the transfer. Churchill flew in another Douglas Skymaster, but also did not sleep well on the flight. The rest of the delegation, all 700 of them, needed 25 more planes, Skymasters and Avro Yorks, to reach Yalta. And again, this transfer was only possible because of the collapse of the Axis. Only a little more than a year earlier, crossing the Mediterranean safely was impossible. Churchill and Roosevelt required extremely circuitous routes to get to the Tehran Conference in November 1943. And did I say safely about the Mediterranean? Maybe the warplanes of the Italian Air Force and the Luftwaffe no longer flew over those waves, but one of the three planes carrying Churchill's contingent to Malta crashed into the sea on 29 January, killing all aboard. In addition, the reason they had to take planes instead of ships was because German U-boats were still plying the waters of the Atlantic and the Mediterranean. So, what happened at Yalta? Well, I'm going to deviate from most historical descriptions of this conference. I'm going to describe the outcome first and then get into how the participants got there. Because I know you want to hear what came out of Yalta. Why bother going to Yalta? In brief, here are the headlines from the final statement from the Yalta conference. So the first statement, the first declaration was the demand for an unconditional German surrender. The three leaders, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, agreed that the war would only end with Germany's unconditional surrender, no terms. And then Germany would be divided into four zones occupied by, respectively, the US, the UK, France, and the USSR. Exactly where the boundaries between the zones would be were going to be worked out. They decided they would be worked out later by other people, a committee on the dismemberment of Germany. Similarly, the capital, Berlin, would be divided among the four victors. Stalin only accepted France having its occupation loan grudgingly, and only if that were carved out of the British and US zones. So the Soviets got their zone, the rest of Germany, the others could work it out. The next and related declaration was the denazification and demilitarization of Germany to prevent it from creating a third world war. This provision included punishment of German war criminals, but not Soviet war criminals. The next demand was war reparation. Germany would pay reparations, especially to the Soviet Union, for the destruction it had caused. Now, initially, Stalin demanded $20 billion in such reparations, kind of just threw that number out there. Churchill pointed out that Germany had not even been able to pay $1 billion after the First World War. So, after some negotiation, Stalin accepted that much of the reparations could be repaid in the form of labor. In other words, slavery. Stalin then agreed that the Red Army would enter the war against Japan after Germany's defeat, in return for the Kuril Island chain north of Japan and southern Sakhalin Island, as well as other concessions. Stalin also agreed that U.S. Army Air Force B-29 bombers could be based in the Russian Far East to allow them to bomb Japan's home islands. Although, as it turned out, this never happened. As I know you listeners appreciate. The next declaration of the Big Three from Yalta was the agreement on the formation of the United Nations. This was Roosevelt's dream, building on the idea of the League of Nations after the First World War, but avoiding its weaknesses and its errors. Stalin was suspicious of it, but eventually came around for a price, of course. He had first demanded that all 16 Soviet Socialist Republics get their own separate seat, and therefore they each get a vote, as if each one of them had an independent government. Roosevelt and Churchill knew this was a means of getting irresistible influence in this new body. and resisted it. Eventually, Stalin agreed to just 3 separate votes from the USSR, one for the USSR itself, one for the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, and one for the Belarusian Soviet Socialist Republic. And these two, as you know, always voted along with the USSR. The next declaration was democracy. All 3 powers agreed at the conference that all liberated European and former Axis countries would hold free, fair elections after hostilities ceased. In other words, they reaffirmed or affirmed the principles of the Atlantic Charter, the right of all people to choose their own form of government. Yes, Stalin agreed to this, but the sincerity of that agreement, we'll get to that. Poland. Well, Poland's fate was a major disagreement on each day of the conference. It came up over and over again. While the official agreement at the end was that Poland would have free and fair elections, Stalin insisted from the beginning on control of Poland as a security guarantee. Poland, he said, had been the corridor for invasion of Russia from the east more than twice. He also insisted that the pro-communist provisional government the Red Army had installed in Warsaw would govern Poland up to and through the so-called free and democratic elections. He rejected the return of the government in exile from London, which the Poles had elected before the war in 1939. But he did accept the addition of some members from it in the new provisional government, expanding it rather than replacing it. I'll get into Poland more deeply in a few minutes. But those are the major points agreed on at the Yalta Conference. It's important to note, though, that these declarations were short on detail. They're, you know, very grand-sounding statements. While Churchill and Roosevelt were great on overarching noble principles like freedom of all nations to choose their form of government and denazification of Germany, they were vague on how these ideas would actually be implemented in reality. Stalin, on the other hand, remained firm in his demands throughout, right down to the details. Any concessions he made were either cosmetic or violated soon after the fighting ended. So that's the declaration out of Yalta. Let's take a look now at how the negotiations actually went. We'll do that after this break.
As Scott elegantly describes in each episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the war on the Eastern Front was truly gargantuan, both in terms of its geography and its destructiveness. But given that there is so much territory to cover, and that so many millions of men were involved in the fighting, it's perhaps inevitable that some battles from the Eastern Front get overlooked. I'm David Sumner, and I'm the host of Europe at War, a weekly podcast exploring lesser-known battles and stories of the Second World War, with a particular focus on the Eastern Front. From the drama of thousands of trapped German soldiers and terrified civilians attempting to break out of the Halber Pocket, to the unexpected and blistering counterattack launched by German forces on the Red Army during the Battle of Bautzen, many of the Eastern Front's most dramatic battles, particularly those which happened towards the end of the war, have long been neglected by historians, and their stories have remained untold. Until now. So to hear these incredible tales from the Eastern Front, and more, check out Europe at War, available on all podcast platforms. Thank you. Now let's get back to the show.
Hi, Scott here. I hope you're enjoying this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, Podbean, or whatever podcasting platform you listen to it on. That helps let other people know about it. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War between the USSR and Finland, and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel. And all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now let's get back to Scott exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Welcome back. This is part two of episode 93 of Beyond Barbarossa, from Malta to Yalta. So by 3rd February, we have the big three leaders in Yalta in the Crimea. And you probably are wondering, why Yalta? The previous big three conference had been in Tehran, Iran, which is a place that was not within any of the countries of the big three leaders. This time it's in the USSR. Stalin did not have to leave the country he controlled to get to this conference. Churchill, and especially Roosevelt, had to travel long distances to get there. Roosevelt had to cross the Atlantic Ocean, which he had to do so in a large cruiser, a U.S. Navy cruiser, accompanied by a fleet of destroyers because of those German U-boats in the Atlantic Ocean. So why Yalta? Well, Roosevelt had suggested a conference to be held in a neutral location. He'd suggested several, including Malta, as well as Cyprus, Sicily, Athens, even Jerusalem. But Stalin said his doctors did not want him to take a long journey all the way to Malta or Cyprus or even Jerusalem. So he insisted on Yalta, former playground of the Tsars. Some historians also claim that Stalin was afraid to fly, and he didn't have to fly to get to Crimea. While Stalin made the admittedly long journey from Moscow to Yalta, it's close to 1,400 kilometers, which is more than 800 miles. He did so on a train built for Tsar Nicholas II, so you can just imagine the luxury. Roosevelt and Churchill traveled farther on military transport planes from Malta, with interiors that were nothing like the flying living rooms of today's jet airliners, even though they probably had more legroom. So those two leaders arrived in Crimea in far worse shape than the Soviet dictator did. Now, curiously, both Churchill and Roosevelt brought their daughters along for the conference, Sarah Churchill and Anna Roosevelt Bodiger. Anna acted as her father's advisor, as well as confidant and helper, because by this point, Roosevelt could only move around by wheelchair. Even deplaning required a specially installed mechanical lift. And if you notice, all the pictures of Roosevelt from this conference show him sitting, never standing. There was a third young woman on this delegation, Kathleen Harriman, daughter of Roosevelt's key advisor, Avril Harriman, who himself was had been the head of the Union Pacific Railroad before the war. He was a close friend of Roosevelt, and in 1940, the architect of the Lend-Lease Plan. If you want to know more about that, you can go back to episode 32. In October 1943, Harriman became the U.S. ambassador to the USSR, and his daughter Kathleen was with him the whole time. The American and British delegations arrived at the Saki airfield in Crimea the next morning, 3rd February. Saki is on the west coast of the peninsula, but Yalta is on the southeastern coast. So getting from Saki to Yalta required another trip, 8 hours driving over poor, mountainous, battle-scarred roads. I'm going to quote from Giles Milton's excellent book, The Stalin Affair. Stalin had the entire 80-mile route to be lined with troops, two Soviet divisions, who each stood in sight of the next one. Quote, as the presidential car passed, noted Roosevelt's interpreter Charles Bolin, the soldiers, many of them girls, snapped to the Russian salute. Repeated thousands of times, the salute was most impressive. End quote. They arrived in Yalta to find it also heavily damaged. The Germans had looted everything they could carry when they retreated. However, partly to make up for the long journey and mostly to impress their guests, the Soviets had been busy preparing appropriately luxurious accommodations for weeks. They put the British delegation at the Vorontsov Palace, the former German headquarters during the occupation, built for Prince Vorontsov of Imperial Russia. The Americans stayed at the lavish Livadia Palace in Yalta proper, the former summer retreat of Tsar Nicholas II. And the Soviets stayed in the slightly less decadent Yusupov Palace, built for Prince Felix Yusupov. I put pictures of the three settings, the three palaces, on the webpage for this episode. The Soviets spent a lot of resources restoring these palaces to make them as luxurious as possible, and by that I mean they bugged them. Full of listening devices that recorded every word the American and British delegates said, especially the leaders. Sergei Beria, the son of Lavrenty Beria, the head of the AKVD, or secret police of the USSR, was in charge of putting those listening devices in. And the Soviets did not try hard to disguise them, really. More than once, Stalin quoted the conversations Churchill and Roosevelt had had in what they thought was private the next day during negotiations. For example, on the morning of 6 February, Churchill had breakfast with his personal doctor and mused about the possibility of a future war between the UK and the Soviet Union. That evening, in the plenary session, Stalin raised the same point, quoting Churchill's words almost verbatim. Quote, they all knew that as long as the three of them lived, none of them would involve their countries in aggressive actions. But after all, 10 years from now, none of them might be present. End quote. With hindsight, those are chillingly ironic words. What's clear is that Stalin never meant what he said to Roosevelt. To quote again from Giles Milton, observers of the conference were quick to notice Stalin's obvious skills. Where Roosevelt rambled and Churchill delivered monologues, Stalin remained utterly focused. A shrewd and skillful negotiator, thought Roosevelt's translator Charles Bolin. Always calm and unruffled, and almost always courteous in his mood and manner. This was especially the case with Poland and Eastern Europe. He showed himself to be a master of evasive and delaying tactics with no great regard for facts. He had done his homework on the principal issues, but he did not hesitate to cite events and actions which Churchill and Roosevelt, to say nothing of the rest of us, profoundly disbelieved but could not refute. End quote. Poland is the best example of this. Churchill came to the meeting hoping to preserve Poland as a viable, free, independent democracy. After all, Britain had guaranteed Poland's security before 1939, and along with France, failed to do anything about its dismemberment. Let's not forget the Polish pilots who defended in the Battle of Britain, and Polish fighters at D-Day in the Netherlands and at Operation Market Garden. But Stalin countered with, quote, if Poland was a question of honor for the British, it was for the Russians a question of life or death, end quote. From the Yalta Conference, the history of the Allied meeting that shaped the fate of Europe after World War II. Quote, Stalin shrugged off Western appeals to honor and fairness by forcefully invoking security and the life or death nature of Russia's need to block Germany's invasion corridor into Soviet territory. End quote. He reduced Poland here to an invasion corridor, not a nation. Roosevelt again took Stalin's side in this because he wanted Stalin to agree on joining the United Nations as well as the war against Japan. So the three agreed to the limp declaration of a, quote, provisional government of national unity, end quote, in Poland, which meant the communist stooges Stalin had already installed, and a vague and unenforceable commitment to free and unfettered elections. Stalin also wanted the post-war eastern border of Poland to be along the so-called Curzon Line, which had been the dividing line between German and Soviet-occupied Poland in 1939. This meant that thousands of square kilometers of eastern Poland would be incorporated into the puppet Soviet Socialist Republics of Lithuania, Belarus, and Ukraine. In compensation, Poland would get German territory on its western side, as well as the once free city of Danzig, now Gdansk, Poland. Take a look at map 4 on the webpage to see just how significant this was. Stalin basically moved Poland 100 miles westward. In this part of the negotiation, Roosevelt tried to get Stalin to agree to leave the city of Lwów, now Lviv, in Poland. But the dictator rejected that idea. And partly that's why Lviv is now in Ukraine. To quote Antony Beevor's The Second World War, "For what appeared to be the greater good of world peace, Roosevelt was not prepared to stand up to the Soviet dictator." End quote. This is the most horrifying agreement from Yalta, the fate of the displaced people of Eastern Europe. It started with the desire of the democracies to bring their prisoners of war home. Many of the Germans' POW camps, holding Western fighters, were now in Red Army hands. And of course the democratic leaders wanted to bring these people back home. Meanwhile, their camps were full to bursting with Wehrmacht prisoners. And among them were many non-Germans from occupied countries. These were people from Eastern and Central Europe who, for whatever reason, had joined the German forces. And there were also Hiwis or Hivis, people from areas captured by Germany who were forced to work for them, often through starvation. These included tens of thousands of Russians, Ukrainians, Belarusians, and Baltic people. There were also Cossacks and others who fought alongside the Germans. As Professor Lyubomir Luchuk pointed out, there were Ukrainian fighters who had been incorporated into the Waffen-SS. They fought for a Ukraine free from Russia, as well as from Germany. There were also Croats, Slovenes, and Serbs, and more who did not want to live under communism. Under the terms of the Yalta Agreement, all POWs would be returned to their home countries, including all those who had fought against communists and those who had been forced, through starvation, to work for the Germans. Antony Beevor explains it this way. The British and Americans guessed that Stalin wanted revenge on all those Soviet citizens, around a million of them, who had served in Wehrmacht uniform or who had been forced through starvation to become Hivis. However, they did not foresee that even those taken prisoner by the Germans would be considered traitors. By the time the Allies discovered the truth about the murder of returned Soviet prisoners, they preferred to remain quiet so as not to delay the return of their own prisoners of war. And finding it impossible to screen their charges effectively to identify the real war criminals, it seemed easier to send the whole lot back by force if necessary. So what can we say about the Yalta Conference? Clearly, Stalin got what he wanted. He forced the Americans and British to accept all his desires for an Eastern Europe under his control, from the Baltic Sea to the Adriatic, although Yugoslavia would soon prove to be a difficult prize for the Soviets to hold. Much has been made of Churchill's impotence and Roosevelt's naivete at Yalta. But really, they had little choice. By February 1945, the Red Army already controlled nearly all the territory that would soon be part of the Soviet Empire. Britain was broke, and the Americans had no appetite for another war with the USSR immediately after defeating Germany. Besides, in February, they were still at war with Japan, and at that point, no one knew whether an atomic bomb would ever work. Oops, spoiler. Sure, the Red Army had only gotten as far west as they had by early 1945 because of Lend-Lease, particularly the hundreds of thousands of trucks, jeeps, tanks, and warplanes the US, UK, and Canada gave to the Soviet Union. On the other hand, not delivering that aid would have meant millions more dead Americans, Brits, Canadians, French, and yes, Poles. Yalta made it plain to the British and American delegations and to the world what Stalin's and the USSR's nature and goals were. And they knew they weren't about to change that. Thank you for listening to Beyond Barbarossa, the podcast about the Eastern Front of the Second World War. For a better understanding of the progress of the war, please see the maps and photos on the website, beyondbarbarossa.ca or beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com. Then click or tap on the title for the episode. Tapping the logo will start a player in your browser, which is fine if you want to listen that way. You can also listen to the episode on my own website, writtenword.ca. Click on the podcast button in the banner. Thanks to all who have supported the podcast through Patreon. Until all Ukrainian refugees can return home safely, your financial support goes to charities that help Ukrainian refugees. Please hit the follow or subscribe button in your podcast app. And if you have a minute, a rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, or wherever you listen would help others find it. Oh, and by the way, if you do want to support the show, please go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and choose whatever level of support that you are comfortable with. Patreon supporters get episodes early and ad-free. Do you have something to add? A question, a suggestion, or a correction? I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me by email, scott@beyondbarbarossa.ca, or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. I'm Scott Burry. Until next time, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina. Viva le Canada.